whenever you want to start. Simone, please go ahead.
Okay. So I hope if you don't hear me, let me know. I'll be as close as possible to the microphone. So the point of the seminar today is to debate a little bit the state of the art of spinform models, and in particular the simplicity constraints, and try to put on the table some of the most interesting open questions and some of the methods. And at least I, for my part, will certainly fail to really give an update on the state of the art, because the field grows and expands very fast and is very alive, very much alive. And I'm certainly going to give a biased view on some of the results and some of the problems. So that's why I'm hoping that there will be some debates at the end, so that at least one of the goals of this discussion today can be to agree on what has been achieved and try to agree on what are the next open questions to go for. So in the slide number two, we have like a sketch of the way we organize the discussion. And as I was saying, I will talk for the first half, which will be mainly about classical aspects of spinforms and simplicity constraints, and then Mark will talk about quantum aspects in the second part, and we'll try to be within 40 minutes. So let me start from slide number three then, directly. So I'll try also to, from time to time, remind basic facts for people that are not necessarily familiar with spinforms or for simplicity constraints. But if I'm not pedagogical enough, don't hesitate and interrupt me. After all, one of the points of this is exactly to have a common ground for everyone. So please ask questions whenever you want. So as you know, when we talk about spinforms, we are talking about some covariant approach for the dynamics of loop quantum gravity. So the goal of the game is to write down a partition function or write some transition amplitudes that give quantum dynamics for spin networks of loop quantum gravity. And this we have quite successfully achieved in the last few years thanks to the efforts of a number of people that started back in the 90s. And we have today specifically one model that is very well developed, which is this EPRL model. There are also older models by Barrett and Crane and Weisenberger. There's a model by Aristide and Daniele. And the situation is, for all these models, is that they're typically based on the Plebansky action for general relativity. There has been also some attempts of writing spinform models starting directly from the Holst action. These are much less developed. I mean, the reason for taking the Plebansky action as a starting point is very simple, is that the bivector that appears there as a fundamental variable is the natural conjugate variable to the connection, and these guys form a pair of canonical operators also in loop quantum gravity. So there's really a kinematical reason to take that as a starting point. And the results are, we have some bunch of nice results. In particular, we did achieve this goal of giving transition amplitudes for all spin networks. This was thanks to the effort of the Warsaw group led by Lewandowski to generalize the EPRL model. And in particular, the models are ultraviolet finite, as it was already the case for the Barrett-Crane model. Furthermore, it is possible to show that inclusion of a cosmological constant and quantum deformation of the gauge group leads to infrared finiteness as well, as was conjectured a long time ago. And furthermore, another nice thing of this EPRL model is that it has a good large quantum number behavior and the large spin limit. As you all know, there's the Reggie action that pops up, and this is promising for the complete semi-classical behavior of the model. Of course, there are many big questions that lie ahead of us. The main of all is what happens when we resum the series over the spinforms or take the continuum limit. There's work on this by the tensor track people. There's the alternative approach by Bianca and her group. Another question is, of course, whether this is properly implementing the Hamiltonian constraint from the point of view of low quantum gravity, and Thomas' group is looking at this type of questions. And the other thing is to look at the explicit evaluation of the quantum corrections to see what happens beyond the Reggie behavior and whether we can actually get predictions out of this theory. So this is kind of the broad situation we are in. We have some nice milestones that we have reached, and we have plenty more ahead of us before we can really take seriously this approach to the dynamics of quantum gravity. Now, because of the use of the Blavatsky action as the starting point, this brings to the forefront of the construction of spin-form models the simplicity constraints. So let me briefly remind you what these are in the next slide, number 4. So what these guys do in the continuum is really that they ensure that the theory has the correct number of degrees of freedom. And furthermore, from an Hamiltonian point of view, they have a non-trivial structure because they come in a conjugated pair of primary and secondary simplicity constraints. Typically, the primary can be seen as constraints on the bivector only and the secondary on the connection. I will say more in the next slide. But just to make it clear what happens when you switch from the continuum picture to spin forms, there is a discretization involved, and this complicates the picture quite significantly. First of all, because discretization per se makes it much more obscure, the notion of a physical degree of freedom. Now we only have finite number of degrees of freedom anyways. So this the geometric rule has to be rethought, and I will show you soon how it is being rethought in spin forms. But then there's also the obvious problem that because of the discretization, we don't have any more invariants under diffeomorphisms in the usual sense, so there's no Hamiltonian and a clear notion of primary and secondary constraints. This, of course, it's a huge problem, and this is what Bianca, for instance, is looking at with her perfect action approach. So these type of issues connected with the discretization lead to all sorts of questions and difficulties which are at the forefront of research in spin forms in this model, which are briefly listed at the end of slide number 4. But let me move on to slide number 5. So here we have rewritten with Mark the Blavatsky action, which I'm sure you've seen already a thousand times, just to remind you what these simplicity constraints look like in the continuum. And what they do is that they reduce the bivector to be just a function of the tetrad, so that they introduce a metric, the one derived from the tetrad, in a theory that initially has no metric, but only the bivector B and the connection omega. Now, at the continuum level, these constraints can be analyzed looking at the decomposition into irreducible representations of the Lorentz group, and they have a very clear role. So because B wedge B has the symmetries of the Riemann tensor, you can do exactly the same decomposition that you would do for the Riemann tensor in terms of the Weyl components, the Ricci components, and the Ricci scalar. And what turns out is that the Ricci and Ricci scalar components impose equality of the right and left-handed Urbanke matrix, which is the reason why Mike, back in the day, called this theory left area equal right area general relativity. And this is why I was saying earlier on that the role of this constraint is really to ensure that there's a right number of degrees of freedom. So just one metric instead of two. The Weyl part, on the other hand, it's a little bit more tricky. And what it does is that it really reduces the internal gauge, which is SL3 to begin with, and it reduces it to SU2. And because we have two copies of SU2, that leads to SL2C, and so the Lorentz algebra is the internal gauge. And relaxing these constraints was shown by Sergei and Kirill that leads to an extra bunch of degrees of freedom, and in particular can be interpreted with some reality conditions, at least as a bigravity theory, a theory with two metrics. Now, that said, just to remind you about the structure in the continuum at the Lagrangian level. At the canonical level, as I said, they split in two parts, the primary and the secondary. And in particular, the secondary is giving us the torsion freeness of the spatial connection. So as I said before, the primary can be seen as constraint on the bivectors and the secondary on the connection. That said about the continuum theory, let's move to slide number 6. So they are very important in the continuum theory, but we don't talk about them in spin forms. In fact, in spin forms, we only talk about the primary simplicity constraints. The reason for this being exactly the lack of an Hamiltonian. On the other hand, you might expect that this may lead to some difficulties with the interpretation of the theory because, for what I just said in the previous slide, the secondary ones are really important for understanding the geometrical interpretation of the Ashtekar-Barbero connection, and in particular understanding how this auxiliary SU2 gauge group described by the Ashtekar-Barbero connection is embedded in the true gauge group of spacetime, which is the Lorentzian one. So here I was just repeating that in spin forms a priori we cannot just write down secondary constraints because We don't have an Hamiltonian that we can write down because we're working on a single foam, and we don't have invariants under diffeomorphisms in the usual sense that we can talk about. There's been efforts in order to try to do this. In particular, Mirzi tried, and now Bianca is doing something along these lines as well. So it is not to be excluded that there might be developments, and I think that's one of the directions that we should try to focus on. If we now move to slide number 7, what was the solution that was taken in order to build up spinform models in the lack of a natural Hamiltonian and a natural notion of secondary constraint? Well, the idea proposed by Barrett and Crane was, okay, let's forget about discretizing the Hamiltonian and deriving secondary constraints. Let's just look at what the end result of the primary and secondary constraint is. This end result is the fact that we have a unique Riemannian structure, because we have some metric that comes out of the bivectors, and we have a Levi-Civita connection that comes out from the torsionlessness condition. So let's try to actually reproduce the result of imposing the constraints at the discrete level instead of discretizing the constraints. And this can be done thanks to Regge calculus and the fact that there is a unique Riemannian structure associated to a simplicial triangulation specified by the edge lengths of all the triangles. And in particular, what Barrett and Crane showed is that you can give a reconstruction theorem that allows you to recover a Regge triangulation starting from bivectors only. Bivectors that used to be called B in the previous slide, I think, and now in the slide number 7 are called X. So this is just a short upshot of the Barrett and Crane construction. They show that you can discretize the constraint. They're quadratic in the bivectors, and they involve the epsilon star Hodge dual operator here. And this leads to a unique metric for simplex. Not only they show this, but they also show something quite interesting for what concerns the issue of secondary constraint. If you see in the top part of slide number 7, there's three types of simplicity constraint: the diagonal of diagonal and volume simplicity. And now the volume simplicity, they do involve the connection. Hello? What? Question or? Okay, I can go. So although it is written in a way that the connection does not appear, in order to take those traces, one should parallel transport the bivectors that appear on opposite faces of the four simplex into the same common frame. So this third type of simplicity constraint actually involves the connection. And so one could see it as some type of secondary constraint. However, very importantly, this constraint is redundant once one takes the Regge logic that the four simplices should be flat in their interior. Because if one imposes the diagonal of diagonal simplicity, the flatness of the four simplex, and the closure of each individual tetrahedron, then this sort of secondary constraint becomes redundant. Which led to the logic at the end of the 90s that, well, because we are imposing the primary simplicity constraints at all times, there's no need of secondary constraints somehow. So this was kind of the logic of the Barrett-Crane model. Let's move to the next slide, slide number 8. That logic might be fine. However, there are difficulties with the Barrett and Crane model. As you know, it doesn't really reproduce the Regge equations of motion because of the variation only varies with respect to independent areas and not independent edge lengths. And there are other important problems with the models. It does not incorporate any Mirzi parameter. And it does not provide the transition amplitudes for all the spin network states because of the uniqueness property of the Barrett and Crane intertwiner. So there are difficulties with this model that have prompted some further developments that led to this EPRL spinform model. In particular, with this EPRL spinform model, now we can address questions, because we have gamma, we can address questions like, what is the role of the Mirzi parameter in the embedding of the boundary spin network in the spinform model, and what is the relation between the Levi-Civita connection that this Barrett-Crane logic introduces and the holonomy flux algebra that lives on the boundary of the spinform models. So these questions, at least here, is where I'm going to be a bit biased, but I think these questions can be very nicely addressed using this twisted geometry framework or the spinorial framework, because there you are somehow bridging between the holonomy flux algebra and the Regge behavior, and you can look at both sides of the picture in a unique framework. So this is what I think it's this is promising for. And so let me just remind you then, this is just a reinterpretation of the standard holonomy flux algebra of loop quantum gravity or covariant loop quantum gravity. In terms of polyhedra, in terms of a collection of polyhedra, and they generalize radial geometries because there's some discontinuity that is allowed in the metric. But what is more important to me is that they allow us to see exactly where the extrinsic geometry sits and understand in what sense the extrinsic geometry can be reconstructed out of the HU2 data. Because if you take this twisted geometry picture, then you can show explicitly that the diagonal part of the simplicity constraints, which is actually first class, is the only part that is first class, has an orbit which allows you to change what would be the rigid dihedral angle, provided the shape matching condition hold. But because they don't, it's a more fuzzy object. But nevertheless, it's the object where one would expect the extrinsic geometry to be encoded. And this is a gauge orbit. Now, it's a gauge orbit because the primary simplicity constraints by themselves leave the diagonal one first class. Suppose now some secondary constraints come into the picture and they change this first class nature into a second class nature, like they do in the continuum. Then it would reproduce exactly the same picture you have in the continuum, that is that a non-trivial gauge fixing of this orbit gives you, it's provided by the secondary constraints and gives you the embedding of the SU2 connection in the Lorentzian phase space. So these we've learned thanks to this reparametrization, and I think it's something, it's some step ahead in our understanding of spin foams, and in particular I think is exactly related to this issue of flatness that has been recently pointed out by Frank Wojtek and also Claudio Perini concerning the large spin behavior of the EPRL model. Why I say this is because of what is written in this remark, is the fact that these spin foam models carry from the regio logic also the notion that the holonomy should just lie in a plane. This is consistent if you're talking about the Levi-Civita connection. This is not consistent if you're talking about the Ashtekar-Barbero connection. And therefore, by inconsistent, I mean that it will only lead to flat solutions. And therefore, to get out of this problem, one needs to be able to distinguish properly between these two connections. Therefore, one needs to be able to understand the role of the secondary constraints and this embedding I was talking about. And just to finish my classical part, I might be a little bit running out of time. So I just have two more slides. So, okay, now that we understood that, this should be the role of the secondary constraints, how do we address the fact that actually we have no Hamiltonian that generates the secondary constraints? Well, so I'm on slide number 9 now. Well, Bianca and Jimmy proposed, let's forget about Hamiltonian and secondary constraints. Let's just try to discretize the constraint as a torsionless condition. And they argue that this would lead to the Levi-Civita connection of Regge because discretizing the torsionless condition automatically imposes the shape matching conditions as well. Now, this is very strong because, of course, the shape matching is a much smaller subspace than the usual kinematical phase space of loop quantum gravity. So this has caused some questions, and then there was a response by my friends here in Marseille that showed that actually you do not need to impose the shape matching conditions in order to solve a torsionless condition at the level of twisted geometries. So the question remained a little bit open, and in fact, Fabio Ansa last year at the Loop Quantum Gravity Conference in Perimeter showed you the answer to this, which is quite a nice answer. He worked on a little toy model, just a single force simplex and an Hamiltonian that imposes flatness. This is the only case in which we know that we control the Hamiltonian exactly because it's trivial, and then we can actually compute the secondary constraints for real. He could do that, and he could show that the secondary constraints do arise. They do exactly what I said before, namely they provide the embedding of the SU2 phase space into the larger phase space. However, Bianca and Jimmy are also right, because the solution to the secondary constraint requires the shape matching conditions as a consistency for the reality of the dihedral angle. So at least for the force simplex and flatness, it is true that one can imagine that the torsionless condition and shape matching conditions talk to each other. However, beyond the force simplex, the situation might be different. So to conclude, slide number 10, I think that with the present level of understanding that we have for the classical geometry, what we really need to focus on is to better understand the interplay between torsion and the Hachette-Gerber-Bernoulli-Civita connection, not necessarily within the Reggio framework, so maybe also beyond for symplices. And in particular, we should take seriously into account a condition like torsion equals zero, strong, weak, to be debated, but to be added to the spinform models, as Wolfgang was suggesting in some of his papers. And an alternative also would be to look at the spinning geometries recently proposed by Jonathan and Loran. And I think I should stop at this point because I'm already running out of time and let Mark continue with the quantum part before opening the floor, let's say, to some discussion.
Okay, thank you, Simone. So I don't know, maybe we should take some questions. Ask questions about the classical part. Okay, if there are no questions, then I'd like to continue with slide 11.
So
can everybody hear me okay?
Can you get closer to the mic, please?
Actually, so I'm not sure. Is it okay?
It's better, but please speak loud.
Okay. So now I'm on slide 11, and as Simone said, I would like to now propose a transition from all these facts about the classical theory and classical properties of the simplicity constraints, and I would like to talk about the quantum theory now. And of course, to talk about the quantum theory, probably it's nicer to start with the path integral approach, because precisely what we're trying to do with spinforms is propose a description of, as Simone said, a regularized path integral for gravity. And in fact, if we think working with an action such as the Plebensky action and studying its canonical structure by doing a canonical analysis, in fact, there is sort of a canonical path integral which we can write down, and which is the phase-based path integral. And so this phase-based path integral, which is the first line on this slide, you see it's written as an integral over fields in the phase space, so the connection omega A, ij, and its conjugate momentum. And then there is, so in full generality, a delta imposing first-class constraints. Then this capital delta 1 would be the determinant of the matrix of Poisson bracket between the first-class constraints and some gauge-fixing functions. Then this product is the product over precisely this gauge-fixing function. Then there is this delta of second-class constraints and this square root of the determinant of the matrix of brackets between the second-class constraints. And in fact, you see that from this point of view, if you look at this path integral, it is quite clear that if you would like to sort of discretize this path integral and write it in a spinform form, we have to care about a full set of second-class constraints. And as Simone pointed out, if you look at the canonical analysis of the Plebensky action, these second-class constraints, precisely because they are second-class in the continuum, means that they come in a pair. So there is primary second-class constraints and secondary second-class constraints. And so these are all described by this delta of second-class constraints. But so now what one can do is use a trick which is known as the Enos-Lavnov trick, which can be used to go back from the phase space path integral all the way back to the configuration space, or the so-called Lagrangian path integral. And so if we do this, basically the idea is to use some canonical transformation generated by the primary second-class constraint in order to remove, basically from the exponential or from the delta function, in order to remove the secondary second-class constraint. And so of course this is necessary because if you want to go from the phase-space path integral in the presence of secondary second-class constraints to the configuration space path integral, at the level of the configuration space there are no secondary constraints. So we have to sort of remove the secondary constraints. And this is what this Enos-Lavnov trick enables us to do. But the price to pay, in fact, if one wants to use this trick and to remove the secondary second-class constraints from the path integral, is that essentially we are going to trade the secondary second-class constraints for local measure factors, which depend essentially on the D field. And so these measure factors have been computed. And for example, I have written here that this measure factor for the whole section is some power of the 4 volume times the power of the 3 volume. And for the Plebensky action, it's the same structure, but just different powers of these volumes. This has been computed by this this list of people. And so I think that also recently, Jonathan Engel and collaborators have proposed to write down a purely geometric Lagrangian path integral. And by this, And what he means is that we want to get rid of the connection, in fact. So it would be like taking the second line, the second path integral, so the Lagrangian path integral with both the bivectors and the connection, and integrating out the connection degrees of freedom. So this is why in this purely geometric path integral, you can see that the curvature is the curvature of the connection, which depends on the D field. And so one can already notice, interestingly, that at this point, of course, if you write this purely geometric Lagrangian path integral, the emergency parameter can play no role in this expression, because in some sense, the Hall's term that we add in the Plebensky action is already vanishing at the level of this path integral because of the Bianchi identity. So maybe we can keep this question for the discussion later on, but this will, imagining that if we could discretize this purely geometric path integral and derive a spin foam out of this path integral, so if this would be possible, this would be very nice, because this would mean that the spin foam model would take into account the measure factors that tell us something about the secondary second class constraints. And so these measure factors here are the four volume power three and then just the three volume. But then if this model does not depend on the emergency parameter, then immediately we have the question of what can be the link between this spin foam model and canonical loop quantum gravity, which depends in a very non-trivial way in the Barber emergency parameter. Although we don't know what the dependency on the emergency parameter of the dynamics is, one can suggest that there maybe can be a tension here between these two approaches.
Question?
So as I say in the, yes?
Good question. What is the, this is a continuum talking about. What is the three volume of three volume of?
Sorry?
What is the three volume of three volume of? There's a four manifold. Well, what is the three manifold whose three volume is in the measure?
Yeah, so this is like a sort of funny feature of the Lagrangian path integral. It was already shown like quite a long time ago for just the ADM path integral. It turns out that this this measure factor is not covariant, in fact. And so this can be maybe seen at first as a strange fact, because one can wonder about diffeomorphism invariance of this. And I think it was nicely explained by Mushin and Thomas Thiemann that that in fact this this measure factor is gauge invariant. In fact, this path integral is gauge invariant. And the point is that just for these theories, so for gravity here, gauge transformation and diffeomorphism, they agree only on shells. So this is why we a priori have this funny feature. But of course, because it looks non-covariant, a priori it's hard to define. So it depends on the slicing. If one wants to discretize this expression and try to put it in a spin-foam form, so this is what I put in this point about the difficulties. If you want to discretize this configuration space path integral a priori, it's probably very hard to do it because of this non-covariance.
Okay, thank
yeah,
you.
Just to clarify, isn't it that it's in fact the volume of the initial space-like slice that you use in the canonical path integral, and then later you show that it's actually diff-invariant, the whole expression. It's like a leftover of your starting point or something like this.
Yeah, exactly. It's exactly what it is, yeah. Because so in the first phase-space path integral, the square root of delta 2, so this determinant of quantum bracket between second-class constraints, contains this three volume. So this three volume in the final path integral, in the Lagrangian one, is just a remnant of the three volume from the phase-space path integral.
As I write
in the second point, probably the most conservative approach would be to do what we just did, so to do as much as we can in the continuum, so gather the structure of the constraints and the appropriate measure factors defining the measure of the path integral, and then try to discretize these expressions and put them in a spin-foam form. But of course, then we run into immediate difficulties, because if you look at the phase-space path integral, the difficulty, of course, is how to discretize the secondary second-class constraints, which is essentially the reality condition or this constraint enforcing that the pullback on the spatial slice of the spin connection be the De Vicci-Vita connection. So this is an extremely hard condition to discretize. But then if one does not want to discretize this condition but rather work with the Lagrangian path integral, then in order for this path integral to be defined, one has to use the correct measure factors. And then the other problem is, of course, how to discretize these measure factors and how to take them into account. So now I jump to slide number 12. And slide number 12, I would like just to comment on the role of the linear simplicity constraint. Because as Simone told you in the classical part, what one usually does in spin foam is to replace part of the quadratic constraint by the linear constraint. So in the end, one ends up imposing only essentially the closure constraint, flatness of the four simplices, and the linear simplicity constraint. However, if we think about the continuum theory, it's clear that there is no continuum formulation of the Plebensky action with linear constraints. And the reason is that if you count these covariant linear constraints, you can see that there are too few constraints. But in fact, this covariant linear constraint is only 18 constraints on the B field, whereas the full set of quadratic simplicity constraints is 20 constraints. So what this is precisely telling us is that if one wants to work with the linear constraints, one cannot forget about the volume simplicity constraints. And in fact, if one just uses as a toy model a Lagrangian, which is a BF term, plus a covariant linear simplicity constraint, this does not describe gravity at all. This just describes the degenerate sector of Plebensky theory, as was shown by Alexandrov. Now, one can wonder what will happen if one just replaces the spatial quadratic part of the simplicity constraint by a spatial part of the linear simplicity constraint. And now this one can do because there is enough spatial linear simplicity constraints to replace the spatial quadratic simplicity constraint. However, if one does this and still keeps quadratic constraints for the constraints involving the B0 part of the bivectors, then one doesn't gain anything because one can see that the secondary constraints that we generate are again the reality conditions. So this means that even if we work with the linear simplicity constraints at the level of the continuum action, the secondary constraints do not simplify at all. They just keep their extremely complicated form, which is the reality condition. Now, at the discrete level, I think that this has an important consequence, which maybe has been overlooked, so it would be good to discuss this, which is the fact that even as if Simone emphasized, at the level of 1-4 simplex, one can replace the discrete quadratic simplicity constraints by the linear simplicity constraint plus the closure constraint. But however, if we think about the path integral, one can see that this replacement has to be done very carefully, because precisely the role of this square root of determinant of the Poisson bracket between the second class constraints in the path integral is here to ensure that, in fact, it is this full product of delta function of the second class constraints times this measure factor that is invariant if you reparameterize the constraint surface. So this means that if we just change the delta function imposing the constraints by itself without changing the measure factors, we trade one set of constraints for an equivalent set of constraints in a non-equivalent way, in fact. So this means that even at the level of the simplicial path integral, if one tries to work with the linear simplicity constraints, one has to try to incorporate the appropriate measure factors, accounting for the fact that we traded the quadratic simplicity constraint for the linear simplicity constraint. Okay, so now I jump on slide number 13. And so on slide number 13, I would like to propose and review very quickly a simple toy model for illustrating this role of the secondary second class constraints. And so this toy model is essentially what one could call a 3D Plebensky action. And so what it does is essentially writing Euclidean 3D gravity, so SU2 3D gravity, using a covariant embedding of this theory into a larger gauge group, so into SO4. And because this is, at the end of the day, just describing SU2 three-dimensional gravity, this means that the quantization of this action should reproduce the Poisson-Auréjé model. And so, in fact, the Lagrangian for this theory is just this simple Lagrangian in terms of the B field, the curvature, and this Lagrange multiplier phi. And you can see that because we extend the gauge group to SO4 instead of SU2, one has the freedom now to add a type of Barbaroi multi-parameter to this Lagrangian. And we have a simplicity constraint term, which is here a linear simplicity constraint. And if you look now at the canonical analysis of this Lagrangian, one can see that it has sort of the same canonical structure as the four-dimensional Plebensky action. Namely, it has a primary simplicity constraint, which is this primary linear constraint, so imposing that the B field is simple. And it has also a conjugated secondary simplicity constraint, which we can write explicitly as this covariant derivative of this normal n equals to 0. You see that something quite interesting happens here in this 3D model, is that the secondary simplicity constraint turns out to depend only on the connection and not on the B field anymore. And so because these simplicity constraints have a very simple form, one can straightforwardly discretize them. So we have given on the right the discrete version of the primary simplicity constraint, the discrete version of the secondary simplicity constraint, and now what one can do is just discretize explicitly the phase-based path integral and use sort of a modified measure over the holonomies and the bivectors, in such a way that the measure over the holonomies imposes the discrete secondary simplicity constraint, and the measure over the bivectors imposes the discrete primary simplicity constraint. If one do this, one can look at the vertex amplitude, which I have written here in the connection representation. There is this sum over this label lambda f. So these lambda f are representations of SO4. These JEF are representations of SU2. And in this first expression, this function S, which is on the right-hand side, is a projected spin network state. So all I'm saying here, what is written here, is that these projected spin networks, as was shown by Alexandrov, are just generic boundary states of spinform models. And so this vertex amplitude here is written as a sum over projected spin networks weighted by this vertex amplitude written on the second line. And now this vertex amplitude on the second line is the one which we would like to evaluate to get the right, the vertex amplitude of our spinform model. And one can see quite easily that if we use the correct measure over the holonomies, so the measure coming from taking into account the secondary simplicity constraints, one gets indeed as the vertex amplitude the 6J symbol, as we expect from the fact that we want to recover the Ponzano-Regge model. And then one can simply see that if we transform back this vertex amplitude in the connection representation back to the bivector representation, and then glue all the contributions together using the measure on the bivectors, which is imposing primary simplicity constraints, one just gets to the Ponzano-Regge spinform model. So now on slide 14, I want to comment on this result. And so the first lesson from this simple result is that one can see that the emergency parameter gamma plays absolutely no role in this construction. In fact, you can see that if you go back on slide 13, that the secondary simplicity constraint does not involve the emergency parameter. And the secondary simplicity constraint alone is enough to guarantee that we get the right vertex amplitude. And so the second bullet point that I put here is to tell that the result is sort of trivial, because already at the level of the Lagrangian path integral, in fact, one can see that what we're just computing is this integral over the Lagrangian which we started with, and these two delta functions imposing the simplicity constraint. And one can see if we compute just this simple expression where I have removed all the labels of the faces and the vertices and the edges, that indeed the emergency parameter plays no role in this expression. It completely drops out of the partition function at the end of the day. And so the lesson from this model is that the correct dynamics is obtained after imposing only the secondary simplicity constraints, while the primary simplicity constraints, they play only sort of a trivial role at the end of the day once we glue all the amplitudes back together. And this is sort of natural, because if you think about the fact that the secondary constraints come from the commutation of the primary constraints with the Hamiltonian, it is really, in this sense, the secondary constraints which probe the dynamics, because they know about the Hamiltonian, because they come precisely from a Poisson bracket of primary constraints with the Hamiltonian. And also, one can think the primary constraints, what they do is they constrain the bivectors XF, which live on the boundaries of tetrahedra, or on the boundaries of four simplices. So they constrain, if we want, boundary data, boundary information. Whereas the secondary simplicity constraints, they constrain holonomies, so GVE, which live inside the simplices, so inside the tetrahedra in this 3D model, or inside the four simplices. So it's sort of natural, it's not a surprise, that the correct vertex amplitude, so the correct dynamics for this model, is obtained after imposing the secondary constraints. And the primary constraints, they play really an auxiliary role. And so the next point is that this construction agrees so by construction, by definition, with canonical quantization, because what we have computed is just the phase-phase path integral. And one can also see, if we play around with this model, that if we do any other imposition of the constraints in which we use, in which we give a very strong role to the primary constraints and sort of forget about the secondary constraints, we do not get the Ponzano-Regge model. In fact, what we get out of this toy model is something that is not even topological, that does not really capture this feature of three-dimensional gravity. And finally, the last point is that this model is, in fact, exactly soluble, precisely because, as I said earlier, the secondary constraints have a very simple form. Namely, they do not depend on the bivectors. They depend only on the connection. And this, of course, is not true in four dimensions. Because in four dimensions, the secondary simplicity constraints, they impose a relation between the connection and the bivectors. So now slide number 15. So just a remark here on slide number 15. I want to say that in four dimensions now, one could think, because we have this canonical structure of loop quantum gravity so formulated with the SU2 Hashtag-Carbar-Barrow connection, what one could think of doing is to rewrite the phase-space path integral in terms not of the spin connection, but instead in terms of the covariant Hashtag-Carbar-Barrow connection. And the reason for which one can do this is that we know the explicit relation between this covariant Hashtag-Carbar-Barrow connection, which is denoted by A here, and the spin connection, omega. And this is just given by this simple expression where R here is the projection onto the rotation part of the Lie algebra. And one can see that if one writes the secondary constraints of Plebensky theory in terms of this covariant Hashtag-Carbar-Barrow connection, these constraints take also a very simple form, which can again be discretized into this expression in terms of the holonomies and the normals. So one could think of imposing this constraint at the level of the path integral. However, what we just saw is that these discrete secondary constraints, if we impose them in the path integral, what we get at the end of the day is just SU2BF theory. And so the reason for this apparent tension is that, in fact, this procedure is not really allowed because the Hashtag-Carbar-Barrow connection is not a space-time connection. And sort of an equivalent statement, which you can see, is that the Hashtag-Carbar-Barrow connection, once we restrict it to the surface of the second-class constraints, does not agree with the spin connection. So this means that if one were to start from the Plebensky action and use this relation between the spin connection and the Hashtag-Carbar-Barrow connection to write the Plebensky action in terms of the Hashtag-Carbar-Barrow connection, one would get additional highly complicated terms which do not vanish on the surface of the second-class constraints. So this would completely spoil the procedure of the Plebensky action, which is to write gravity as BF theory plus constraints. So this is the reason for which this is not an acceptable solution. So now on slide number 16, so I just want to review very quickly what happens here. Maybe there is too much, we don't have too much time left, but this is just to say that I think that the way out of this puzzle, so what we saw so far is that if you try to be very conservative, look at the continuum path integral, so either the Lagrangian path integral or the phase-space path integral, we have two problems. The problem at the level of the phase-space path integral is that we cannot discretize the secondary constraints, and the problem at the level of the Lagrangian path integral is that we don't know how to take into account the measure factors. So for this reason, I think that one way out of this problem, one way to circumvent these problems, would be to find a way to generate sort of automatically, in the discrete setting, a set of secondary constraints on the holonomies. And this is what was proposed by Daniele and Aristide in their model in which they construct spin-foam models via non-commutative simplicial path integral. And so the idea of their construction is to use this group Fourier transform to write this field phi of G, so fields of group field theory which have group variables as arguments, to write them via a Fourier transform on these plane waves E of X, to write them as functions of these non-commutative metric variables, so in terms of phi vectors. And so you see that this introduces naturally a non-commutative structure because these plane waves that are used for this group Fourier transform, they inherit the non-commutativity of the group on which we're working. And so by doing this, one can introduce this propagator and this vertex for group field theory. And one can see that if one glues this propagator and vertex together around triangles or faces of the dual complex, one gets these triangle amplitudes. And essentially, the upshot of this calculation, so the message that you can remember from this slide, is that if one glues all these contributions together, one gets essentially, in this simple example, the partition function for discrete BF theory, for simplicial BF theory. But now, however, if one goes on slide number 17, so on slide number 17, so this is a sketch of what Daniele and Aristide have proposed to describe models for gravity through the incorporation of simplicity constraints in this model. And so the way to do this is to first extend this group theory field into functions of the normals n, which we use to impose linear simplicity constraints, and then impose this linear simplicity constraints using this non-commutative delta function. And so now what one can do is add this non-commutative delta function either into the propagator of this group field theory or into the vertex of this group field theory, then again do the same work, glue all the phase amplitudes together, and then if one does this, the interesting point here, the interesting outcome of this calculation is that one gets effective measures over the holonomy. So the final result of this calculation here, which is the last line, so z equals this complicated integral, you can see that in this integral there is this non-commutative delta function which is imposing simplicity of the bivectors in the reference frame of a tetrahedron, which we have chosen as the reference tetrahedron, so tau 0. And we get an explicit measure over the holonomies, which, in fact, if you write it explicitly, means that we are imposing simplicity of the bivectors into all the frames of the tetrahedra around the dual face. So this means that with this prescription, one can write the simplicial path integral, which gives rise to a spinform model, as an explicit integral over so the explicit path integral of BF theory, with a measure on the bivectors imposing primary simplicity, and a measure over the holonomies imposing that this simplicity be consistently imposed on all the frames of the tetrahedra around the face. And because this involves parallel transport, this naturally gives like a new measure over the holonomies. This is an explicit realization of this idea that was mentioned earlier by Simone, which is that one can maybe, in some sense, forget about the secondary simplicity constraints because one can see them as consistency relations if we impose the primary simplicity constraints consistently at all times. So now on slide number 18, I just wrote the general result of this construction, is that the non-commutative simplicial path integral has a measure over the bivectors imposing primary simplicity and a measure over the holonomies, which we can interpret as imposing secondary simplicity. And so also the important point of the construction of Daniele and Aristide is that if they take a non-trivial emergency parameter, the spinform model that they get is different from EPRL and the Friedel-Krasnov model. But however, I think that there is a difficulty with this construction because if we apply this proposal to the 3D time model which we just described earlier, one does not get the Ponsonner-Regis model as the final spinform model. So this means that these effective constraints on the holonomies which are induced by this group field theory construction, they are not the full set of secondary constraints coming from the continuum analysis, but only a subset of these constraints. This means that we're sort of getting closer to the result. We're having some constraints on the holonomies, but not all the constraints on the holonomies. So now, just to finish on slide number 19, I want to propose just another alternative which one could use to induce these discrete secondary constraints, and this was proposed recently by Wolfgang. And so this idea of Wolfgang was to look, so as on these pictures, at a face of the dual complex, and if we look at the pair formed by a face and an edge of this dual complex, so this little triangle labeled by FE, one can think of subdividing this triangle into many sub-triangles, so n such sub-triangles, and then write a discrete action which has n subdivisions on this pair of face and edge. So this is this action Sn, and now what one can do is take sort of a refinement limit in which n goes to infinity. And if one takes this refinement limit in which n goes to infinity, one ends up essentially with this, what I call this semi-discrete action S, which one can rewrite equivalently either as a sum over face actions or as a sum over edge actions, or as a sum over vertex action. And for example, the edge action in this example would be just a sum over the faces which meet at this edge, then an integral over a continuous parameter which is parametrizing the edge, and then a trace of this covariant symplectic potential. And so what this action is, in fact, as one can see, is just a covariant version of the symplectic potential on the cotangent bundle of the Lie group. It is parameterized by a discontinuous parameter t, which maybe one can think of interpreting as a time parameter. So this parameter t runs along the edge e. And in this expression, the covariant derivative is just the usual time derivative in the parameter t, plus the connection t evaluated along this edge e. And so I think that what this does, in fact, is a classical version of the construction by Daniele and Aristide, in the sense that one now has a time variable, so one has a real action, and one can think of adding now to this simple action, which is just BF theory, one could think of adding simplicity constraints and doing a canonical analysis in this time t, and see if indeed this canonical analysis in time t gives rise to secondary constraints. However, I want to finish with this point now. There is an additional challenge for the linear simplicity constraints, because one can ask the question of how, for example, this proposal for working with a semi-discrete action, or the proposal of Daniele and Aristide, how should these proposals distinguish between gravity and the toy models which I have described, so which is 3D Plebensky action or four-dimensional degenerate Plebensky, if both are the form BF plus linear simplicity? Because at the end of the day, what we try to do with these spinform models is to construct a model by imposing BF plus linear simplicity, but in the continuum, BF plus linear simplicity is just a toy model. It's not gravity, in fact. So it is not clear to me how this prescription should distinguish between gravity and this toy model. And I think that, in fact, going back to the measure factors, the only difference between gravity and this toy model, in fact, if you want to write gravity as BF plus linear simplicity, is precisely in the form of these measure factors. And this is why it is important, if one wants to forget about the secondary constraints and work at the level of the Lagrangian path integral, to take into account these measure factors. Now slide 20, just to conclude. So this is just a summary of the achievements that we have so far for spinform models. So what we have is a well-defined spinform framework, so which is a consequence of the work of many, many people. So a few of them are listed here. This framework is fully covariant, so we understand how sort of the SU2 structure of the canonical theory are embedded into SL2C, so we understand this covariance. And these spinform models, they provide amplitude to all, between any kind of spin network. So this is due to the KKL construction. So what we have is a very good control on the primary simplicity constraint and a good control on simplicial large quantum number asymptotics, the fact that we get the Regge action. And we also have a common framework for describing first-order discrete actions. So we have different formulations of this. We have these TFT formulations, these semi-discrete actions, the twistorial method, and the spinorial method. And what we have now is maybe, because of the discussion that we just had today, is a deeper and deeper understanding of the role of the secondary constraint. So of course, related to this role of the secondary constraint, the questions to clarify in the future is really the relationship between the secondary constraint and the torsionlessness connection. And what would be good is to have an idea of how to implement this torsion-free relation at the level of spinform model. And also what one would need is to improve the evaluation of quantum correction. And so just to list the three methods that one can use to do this, so these methods are the twistorial and spinorial methods of Simone and Wolfgang, for example. Also the methods of group free theory that describe the work of Daniele and Aristide. And also maybe one can think of going back to the self-dual variable. And I will stop here. So now we can open the discussion.
So, questions and comments?
Any question? Hello?
No?
Go ahead.
Yes, I don't know if Wolfgang is on the line. Last we heard from him, he was stuck in Washington, D.C. airport.
Yeah, I think
for 2 days. Is Wolfgang there?
No, he's still stuck in Washington.
Okay, so I have a question. So my understanding is that his proposal had another aspect, and I wonder if you can comment on it. That is, the proposal to realize the torsion-free constraint by the secondary torsion-free constraint by the condition that if you normalize the normal to the tetrahedra by the volume of the tetrahedra, the sum over all those four vectors in every force complex vanishes, so a kind of volume conservation.
Indeed. This is an interesting proposal that he put forward, and current spinform models don't have it like a constraint, and it would be interesting to consider it and to discuss whether it should be implemented strongly or weakly and how to go about it. So, in fact, that's one of the directions to go. Yes, I agree.
Okay, thank you.
Maybe related to this issue of strong versus weak imposition, as I pointed out earlier, this could be a trouble because, as we know from the continuum analysis, if we impose all the second-class constraints, as one does by computing, for example, the Dirac bracket, then the dependency of the theory on the emergency parameter disappears, because effectively what one is doing is imposing the torsion-free condition classically at the level of the phase space. And so in this toy model, which is 3D dependency, there the same mechanism happens, because if you impose properly all the discrete second-class constraints, so both primary and secondary, the emergency parameter disappears as well. So one could think that in four dimensions, the same thing happens, in fact. If one day we achieve this goal of knowing how to discretize this torsion-free condition and implement it at the level of the info model, one could probably worry about the fact that this might lead to a disappearance of the emergency parameter. And then one would lose the link with canonical LQGs. But,
other questions or comments?
Well, let me ask a naive question. Nobody else is asking questions. There's a minute. One point of view that might be taken is that as long as you get Reggie back in the large spin limit, you have a model which reproduces an action which is a discretization of general relativity. And maybe these technical fine points are not necessary to worry about. I'm not saying that's my point of view, but it's the point of view that I've heard around. Do you have a comment on it?
Right, yeah, absolutely. That would be perfectly fine. The problem with this is that we don't have that yet. In the case of a restriction to a simplicial triangulation, there's an issue with flatness that was recently pointed out, in the sense that the saddle point equations that one solves in order to recover the Reggie behavior may be compatible with Reggie solutions only when the triangulation is flat. So that's the first difficulty. And the second difficulty is that from the viewpoint of spin networks and loop quantum gravity, one has no reason to restrict to simplicial triangulations, really. And then if you go beyond that and you consider arbitrary cellular decompositions, the KKL spinfo model cannot be shown to reduce to the Reggie action. That's the work to be done. But in principle, if it wasn't for these technical difficulties, that would be perfectly fine. So if we can solve these, I would be very happy for sure.
One other point is that, in fact, in this asymptotic derivation, one sits on shell, in fact. So for this reason, all these asymptotic calculations are completely insensitive to the fact that we don't impose these secondary constraints. So these constraints would be really important in this sense, more for the quantum regime itself than from the asymptotic. So of course, probably they could cure this flatness issue, but what I'm saying is that it's not probably not a good idea to check the relevance of these models by focusing too much on the asymptotic, because one loses precisely information about these secondary constraints.
No, sure. And my own view is that the limit that we should be interested in is many triangulate is many four symplices in a given space-time volume, each with only moderately sized spins, not so one simplex large spin approximation. So I agree with that. It just seems a shame. I mean, the whole point of loop quantum gravity was that the Hamiltonian and Lagrangian both became polynomial because of using the first order formalism and the Isochar connection. And that resulted in a simple quantum theory because polynomial expressions are easy to regularize in terms of Laplace products. And it'd be a shame to lose that simplicity. It is necessary, but it seems like a change to give it up.
But you see, in that old idea of the polynomial constraints, in a sense, most of the nonlinearities of the theory were buried in the reality conditions, in fact.
Right.
And somehow we are seeing basically the same thing here. Most of the non-linearities of the theory are buried in the secondary constraints. Now, this Barrett and Crane logic suggested that maybe they can magically be implemented, and maybe that is not really happening. And as we are trying to point out, it is really necessary to find a way to describe them. And because the models introduce a discretization, it's really not obvious how to do this. So it is really an important stumbling block at this point, I think.
So the message is clear.
The message is that we need to work harder and better understand the geometry, really, I think. This interplay between Levi-Civita and Ashtekar-Barbero connections.
So that's the heart of the issue of the reality condition, isn't it?
Absolutely. I don't want to say it absolutely, but yeah, most likely we'll. The reality conditions in disguise, I could say.
I'm sure somebody wiser than me has questions about this.
Someone trying to ask a question? Yeah, hello?
I hear Laurent.
Yeah, but very remotely.
Just one comment. It was not really mentioned in the talk, but it was the issue of the continuum. The composition between, you know, primary constraints and secondary constraints is really not from the past into cosmology, but now it's from the cosmology. Now, in the case where you discretize time, I visit in the case of people, then essentially the whole discrepancy has nothing to do with specific form, but it has to do with what type of Hamiltonian interpretation you give to pass interval when you discretize time. But then the Hamiltonian interpretation is gone, which is why the point is. So it seems to me that hoping that the discussion can be set up completely at the discrete level, it may be a bit real issue. We need to talk about without talking about the continuum.
No, so I agree that maybe it's not the right thing to do to try to think about this completely in the discrete setting. But as I think, for example, the GFT model of Daniele and Aristide show, maybe there is indeed a way of inducing at least a subset of constraints on the holonomy. So even if this does not do the full job, maybe it could just take us closer to what a realistic model could be. This is something to investigate, because if you have different models, and if these different models differ explicitly on some measure of the holonomies, for example, I think it's worth investigating what really this measure imposes, in fact, the type of constraints they impose.
I just wanted to add a comment. I completely agree with Laurent. Of course, one could say because the Hamiltonian, if at all, it will only arise in the continuum limit, and also the secondaries should. But then also the whole construction of the primary simplicity constraints should be rethought, because that is heavily based on a discrete interpretation of the result of their imposing them. That is metricity, irregular geometries at the discrete level. It isn't really based on what could be then the correct continuum limit, that is the usual Urbanke metrics and such. So I agree that would be very interesting to look at, but the current setup is a setup that encourages more to understand the discrete geometry before the continuum limit, and then this question arises. But should that fail, then I completely agree to go for this other viewpoint, but rethinking the whole construction, not just the issue of the secondary at that stage, also the primaries, like the closure constraints, for instance. Why should we impose that at the level of a single form if at the end of the day what we care of is really only the the Gauss law and the continuum limit that would emerge. But yeah.
Is there any other question? If not, let's thank the speakers again.